from February 25th. Representative Strand, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move approval.
Representative Strand moves the approval of the minutes for February 25th meeting. All in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed? Motion then prevails. That is done. The first item on the agenda is going to be Senate File 58, dealing with .08. And I would just like to let the audience know who's here for the .08 issue, that we are only going to deal with the Attorney General's piece and the cost to the Attorney General. We're not going to take amendments to change the bill in any form unless it deals strictly with the Attorney General's part of it. So Representative Strand will move that Senate File 58, the recommended pass, and where does it go? Transportation Finance?
Just going to ask you that, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Okay. Representative Strand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. As you mentioned, we're just going to talk about the Attorney General's office. This is the .08 bill, and I think you have all the facts on that. We've talked about that for some time. The Attorney General's involvement in DUI cases is generally limited to implied consent hearings, which is a civil hearing, separate from the city prosecutors that do the criminal part of the DUI trial. So that's how that affects the Attorney General's office. I was told, and I have not met with Mr. Peterson, but I was informed that Deputy Attorney General Tim Peterson would be here to answer any questions if we're going to testify, but they're not spoken to him yet.
Okay. Members, you have a fiscal note on your desk. Ms. Roberts, if you would address that.
Mr. Chair, members, the fiscal note, first just to bring it to your attention, it's marked preliminary at the top, but that is only because this is a large fiscal note and some of the other agencies have not finished their part, but the Attorney General's portion of this fiscal note has been completed and signed off by the Department of Finance. The fiscal note shows that the Attorney General is estimating they're going to need two additional attorney positions to cover what they're anticipating to be an increase in the number of implied consent revocation hearings. And the estimated cost for those two positions and the associated support costs and administrative costs is $275,000 in fiscal year 05 and $300,000 in 06 and 07. The fiscal note also shows revenues to the general fund, and this is because for work that the Attorney General, when they provide services to the Department of Public Safety, that should be supported by the Trunk Highway Fund. They then bill the Department of Public Safety for those costs, and the Department of Public Safety's receipts are then deposited in the general fund to offset the cost to the Attorney General's. So you would see that total net cost to the general fund is $217,000 in 05 and $237,000 for each year after that. And then I should also note that I spoke to Mr. Carger, who is in the audience, who's our fiscal analyst for Judiciary Finance. Mm-hmm. And it looks like when this bill is considered in whole, there will be revenues, I believe, coming from license fees at the Department of Public Safety that would offset the cost and the total general fund cost in 05 for all of the agencies.
Okay, so there is going to be an amount transferred from transportation finance.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Fahey.
I wonder if Mr. Carger could actually address that, because the amount that it's going to be raised, if I'm not mistaken, from past committees is like about $60,000, which isn't going to cover even a portion of the expense of this bill. That's all going to be paid for by your county taxpayers. I wonder if Mr. Carter could maybe.
So we need a little education, Mr. Carter.
Not that I was trying to set you up there, Gary.
Mr. Chair, Gary Carter, Fiscal Analyst with Judiciary Finance Committee. The overall fiscal note as it stands right now, and we do not have a copy of the as amended, but it shows that in the first year there will be about $8,000 to the good from the revenues that are coming in from the fines, the surcharges on the fines, and the reinstatement fee. So that's for fiscal year 05, about $8,000 to the good. That does not include currently any money except, you know, going to the locals except for the fine revenue and the surcharge revenue on the fines.
Representative Paymar.
What was the total amount I realize that we're only dealing with one specific part of this bill, but what was the total fiscal note on this? Would you just...
Yeah, total fiscal note for the total expenditures for '05 are about $1.1 million. The revenues that are coming in, the total for that is about $30.3 million. And a lot of the revenues are coming in are dealing with the penalty for the, you know, the Trunk Highway Fund, the federal funds that we will be losing. If you look at the total, you know, the expenditures and the revenues for the general fund for the first year will show a surplus of $8,000. You know, after all the agencies would be taken care of, you know, in their fiscal money.
So, Mr. Chair, transportation money is designated for transportation.
Right.
So, okay, so what is the actual hit on the general fund for all agencies?
The actual hit on the general fund for all agencies is a little under $1 million.
For '05.
For '05, and then for '06, it's about $1.4 million.
Just, remember, just so you know, this is all going, your county taxpayers are going to have to, I supported the bill in Judiciary Committee, but we all need to be clear who's picking up the tab for this.
Well, we've said all along it wasn't going to be a cheap proposition to go into this, and so there's costs associated all the way around in this bill, and that's the problem. So,
Mr. Chairman? There's other costs, too, if we don't enact this bill, and that would be the cost to people that are either injured or have or death or whatever. That's a huge cost, too, and that's why this bill should be passed.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Paymar.
My respondent, Representative Rhodes, is saying, I have no disagreement with you. There's huge costs associated with drunk driving, but this is a pattern that keeps happening in this legislature over and over and over again. We identify a clear social problem and we're not willing to pay for it. We pass it on to our local property taxpayers. And we did it, you're doing it, and we're in the majority, and it's not right.
Follow up, Representative Robes.
It's a fair statement, Terry. The question is we need to act on something like this regardless, and somewhere down the line we're going to have to deal with it financially, but this bill should pass. It's that important.
Mr. Chair. Representative Stras.
And not to belabor the point, but you know, this is a bipartisan bill, and so much of what I've seen in this as this moves from committee to committee is that and we talk about local government impact, and a lot of the decisions about how these will be prosecuted and processed are going to be made at the local level. Some counties put first-time DUI offenders in jail for 2 days. Many do not. Dakota County treats DUI offenders completely differently than some other counties do, where I work in Dakota County. So a lot of that really is driven by local decision-making, frankly. And part of what I think we should make sure we're on the same page today is that while you can negotiate plea bargains at the city prosecutor level, the Attorney General is more of a black and white issue because there's really nothing to negotiate with an implied consent. So, and Mr. Peterson is here today, now if you wish to have him speak.
Okay. Mr. Peterson? Welcome to the committee, and if you'd state your name and your agency for the record, you may proceed.
Chairman, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm a Deputy Attorney General with the Office of Attorney General. Thank you for asking us here. We have put in, as you know, we put in a fiscal note saying that we anticipate a need for two additional lawyers. I'd like to preface anything, though, by saying, first of all, we agree with everybody. We need .08 in the state. We think we need it. We want to make it very clear. The Attorney General's gone up and down the state and made it very clear that he favors .08. Second, I want to make also clear that if we don't get our two lawyers, we're going to prosecute these people. We're going to do the best we can. Lawyers who work in this area work under me, and they're very professional people. They take great pride in their work. They work very hard. They'll keep doing the same thing. And we'll do the best possible job for the state of Minnesota to ensure public safety. That if someone doesn't deserve to have a driver's license, we'll get it from them. So we want to make that very clear. And also, I've worked with Attorney General for 5.5 years or whatever it is. This is the first time we've ever put a fiscal note to ask for more people. Attorney General takes great pride in
we have a third fewer people in our staff than we did when we started in 99. So we do believe we need the two more, and I did some big questions on how we want to deal with this, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And Mr. Peterson, there's no way that we could move some of this caseload and distribute it amongst more of your people in the office rather than bringing on two new people?
It would just mean other work you wouldn't get done.
Okay.
Is it,
how's the Attorney General's budget look right now?
Two years ago.
I know. It's a little tough. Because in the past, I know there's been discussion, and I think in the House bills in the past, the Attorney General was to absorb the cost of this. What is your analysis of your financial situation at this time?
It would be tough. Mm-hmm. But like I said, we would do it. I think probably would do is just, it basically requires just increased caseload for people.
Mm-hmm.
We have 11 or 12 people do this work every day.
Is there a possibility of phasing in one attorney now and one attorney in another year from now? Or?
Actually, we recognize the difficulties you're under, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, anything we need to, if we can get one, it'd be great.
Okay.
Well, I want to be very clear about that. We don't want to be obstructionist or anything, or wave a red shirt. But we just want to make it very clear what we think our cost.
All right, well, maybe we should, this has a few more stops to go. Maybe that's an issue we should look at, and by the time it gets to Ways and Means, and I sit on Ways and Means, maybe we can have that discussion of Ways and Means and final address that cost. I think that's a fair thought for rest of the members of the committee, Representative Rhodes.
Just a question, Mr. Chairman. How does the system work that the Attorney General gets involved? I assume when Sergeant Strand stops somebody for 0.08 or above, the Dakota County prosecutor takes it there. Why don't you give me a scenario how it gets up to them?
First, I ask if they live in District 36.
Sergeant Strand.
That is not true, by the way. But the
by the way, Mr. Chairman, I did a ride along with him, and he's great at directing traffic and stopping people from sliding into each other.
Not to get too complex about this, but the implied consent process is sort of inherently complex. It's a civil, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Peterson, but it's a civil hearing versus a criminal trial. So they are not concurrent with the criminal trial. So a driver, suspected drunk driver, can challenge the probable cause for the stop or the license revocation with the implied consent through the Attorney General's office, and they're tasked with representing the state. So there's a separate implied consent case and a separate criminal case, which are usually on different days. And if the officer or the department loses the implied consent case, it may or may not affect the criminal case, which is almost always after. So it's, frankly, it's relatively efficient, but one of the comments I would make, and I respect the Attorney General's willingness to be pragmatic and work with this, but those are, having been through dozens and dozens of applied consent cases myself, those are scheduled through their office, and they can run concurrently. So the capacity to do those, I think, is somewhat negotiable, and I think that's what you're saying. You're being very straightforward about it. So.
Okay. All right. Any follow-up? Okay. Representative Clayford.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for being late. I've been triple booked pretty much all day, but I've taken some interest in this. And has the Attorney General been asked about the cost to their office and why there may be a fiscal impact that can't be absorbed?
We had that discussion already, okay. Representative Clayford, and my thought is maybe we should look at seeing if they can absorb the caseload first. Second of all, maybe we hire in one attorney in 05. And then reassess where we are in 06, maybe add in the second attorney if we need to. But we don't have a definite answer to that. So I think my recommendation would be is to move the bill on without any appropriation for the Attorney General's office. But then we would have those final numbers by the time the bill comes to Ways and Means. And at that point, then working with the AG's office, I'll offer the amendment to put the number in that we need based on our decision.
Mr. Chairman, my question goes beyond that even.
Okay.
It's last year when we had had some of the reductions in the budget, if I remember right, I was watching one of the television stations, and the gang strike force, I think, was a casualty of the reductions in the budget last year. And the AG came forward, I believe, and said, we happen to have X thousand dollars or millions laying around here have it for this popular political program so we can save the day. And I appreciate that because I'm for the gang strike task force, but then I'm wondering about the less sexy things that are coming through the mix here that we don't have money laying around for. And so I just wanted to kind of ask that in that context, if we, do we just happen to find money laying around when it's something that's you know, politically sensitive, but for things like, you know, mandates and so forth, you know, we don't have money for that. Do you have a response on that at all?
Mr. Chairman, Reverend Seifert. That money, as I recall, was in the last fiscal year's budget. It's not, we didn't mention money the last fiscal year. We don't know. As I recall, that was, and I think that was the case there. Not, I don't quite recall that one, but no, you're absolutely not. We're not. I was saying earlier, this is the first time I've ever come in before. I've been doing this stuff since Attorney General Hatch started in 1999. First time we've ever come in and asked for more people on a given project. We don't like doing this. I don't feel particularly comfortable doing it. We take great pride in the fact we run a pretty efficient office, and particularly lawyers in the public safety section. I think they take a lot of pride in not ever asking for more people or you know, whining about overwork or any of that stuff. It's still simply not the case. I appreciate the question. That's a good question. But to be honest, that's not the issue. We do think we need more. Part of the problem is there's a lot of guesswork involved. There's a very, it's over, every time you change this law, the DWI law, you get a whole pile, a whole ton load of challenges, constitutional challenges and otherwise, that we can't even anticipate. We'd like to anticipate, but every comma is scrutinized. As one of the Court of Appeals justices once told me, he said, there's a very creative and lively defense bar on these issues. These guys sit and look at this stuff, you know, day after day and try to figure out, ha, there's a little weakness no one thought of before. And so just whenever we make this change, we go through just a lot of constitutional issues as to how it should proceed. And then there's this other issue of people being involved in the system. You drop it to 0.08. I started practicing law about 30 years ago. That time was 0.15. And I remember going before judges, I'd do defense work on these things, and some judges simply weren't convinced that someone knew at 0.17 was compared. And you always had that same problem. You've got to have certain judges who are simply more sympathetic to drunk drivers. And we can't do anything about that. That's just human. So we have that issue that we'll be dealing with for at least a number of years as a transition period. We'll eventually all come around, but it does take some time. I think that's an honest statement, as honest as it could be about this issue.
Right, any other comments from members? Do you feel comfortable with moving this on without an appropriation until we get more information, and then we can, I'll offer an amendment in Ways and Means to put in, Representative Kramer? Questions? Or?
No, it's giving.
Okay, yeah. But I think we need to have some information. I will make sure that the committee knows what that number is before we do it, so that you're aware of what we're inserting in here. So, all right. So, we have any further discussions on the AG's portion of the bill? Is there anyone out here to testify for or against it? If not, Representative Strand removes his motion that Senate File 58 be recommended pass without recommendations, and that the bill be re-referred to Transportation Finance. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Polls?
No.
Motion prevails. Okay.
Representative Jacobson, do you want to take the gavel?
And
but Stanek was my seat for 1 year and I think she was a slanted or
thank you, Representative Haas. Long time no see. Welcome before your own committee.
I told you so.
Would you like
to be back?
Moving your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move House File 1946. We recommend to pass and that it would be sent to the floor.
Thank you, Representative Haas. The bill is before the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. a little over a year ago, when I was given the opportunity to chair this committee, we started looking into the budget because of the shortfall. And one of the areas that I focused in on was state vehicles. And at the time, we found a overabundance of state vehicles used by state employees for various uses. Now, I do understand that we need the highway patrol officers to have a vehicle to do their job, the DNR enforcement officers to be out there doing their job. And those are necessary vehicles. But there's a number of vehicles that are being used by employees that really, I question whether they need a car or not. Well, upon further investigation into this whole issue, I was looking at the reimbursement that we were receiving from employees for the use of this car that they were assigned to, and there's where I found that we were not getting reimbursed as a state. In fact, the state of Minnesota spends $500,000 a year for state employees to drive their vehicles back and forth to work. It's taxpayers' money that has to be used for this expense. And the fact that the taxpayers and all the employees here around the Capitol, whether state employees or lobbyists, whoever it is, representatives, we all have to drive our vehicles to work and get to our workplaces, whether we're here or our normal job. And nobody reimburses us. We have the cost for gas, for car payment, maintenance, and insurance. And yet, we have state employees driving vehicles and not reimbursing the state properly for that. When you look at that, and that's what why we have 1946 before us, in the lottery report, it was very interesting that we had three individuals working out of the office in Roseville, and they were driving their vehicles to work, and they were putting on between 20 to 28,000 miles a year. We'll do the math at 38.5 cents a mile is what the IRS requires reimbursement for that. And you can see how much those three vehicles were costing the state alone and the taxpayers. So what we want to do today, members, is this bill is putting into statute the direction that the state of Minnesota, when an employee uses the vehicle for personal use, that means commuting back and forth to work. Now, if somebody picks up a state vehicle, though, and has to drive from St. Paul to St. Cloud for to do their job or attend meetings, that is not personal use. That is a business use. But if they're driving back and forth to the Capitol every day, and that's what's happening in a number of these cars, they will be paying the normal reimbursement rate. So we are going to put into statutes and guidelines so we don't have to address this further with legislative intent in the future, and to clear up really our own statute that says no employee can use a vehicle for personal use in the definition in our statute, and yet that has not been adhered to. So this bill will address that and set up a reimbursement rate based on what the current IRS rules are for that year for reimbursement. And members, we do have an amendment before us that is just some clarifying language that Mr. Shepard came up with to make it a little clearer. So, Mr. Chair, I move the A1 amendment.
Before you do, Representative Haas, I'm not sure if I'm helping or hurting, but just a clarification on the personal use.
Okay.
In the case of an employee, we'll take one of us for an example. If we were to take a state vehicle from the state office building home that night, say tonight, and then to drive to St. Cloud in the morning, I do not believe that constitutes personal use. Is that correct?
Under my understanding, it does not.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Representative Haas moves the H-1946A1 amendment. To the amendment, Representative Haas?
Members, this just is clarifying language that we'd like to put into the bill.
Questions or comments from members? Representative Kahn.
What's the argument that you're not changing conditions and that this should be subject to collective bargaining, and have you informed the unions about doing this?
I have discussed.
I don't object, I don't want to say I object to anything you do. I just wonder how it fits into how we're supposed to treat our employees.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, I have had discussions with Ms. Belisle and Mr. Bergson from the unions
on this issue, and I think we clarified the questions. Ms. Belisle had one question in regards to state commercial vehicle inspectors, and if you notice, they are driving a suburban type vehicle or SUV type vehicle that has the State Patrol logo on it. It has sirens or lights on the top. It has radio equipment, and under IRS code 15B, and actually in the section on page 16, that is a specific exclusion under the IRS code. And Mr. Burson had a similar question to what Representative Jacobson just asked, and we clarified that. And I think Mr. Burson is here today. If you may want him to come up and address that, that's you may want to comment.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Berkson. I represent 11,000 state employees. Our concern is pretty simple. My folks don't have the authority nor the discretion to say, yes, I want to take a car home, or no, I don't want to take a car home. It is mandated by their director, assistant commissioner, deputy commissioner, or commissioner that they will use a state vehicle. In some instances, it's cheaper for our folks to use a state vehicle. In some instances, it's cheaper for them to use their own vehicle and be reimbursed. But in all instances, my people have no discretion. It is our concern that this legislation would come into conflict with that when the employer says you have to take a car home. Our concern is that then they're going to have to be forced then to reimburse for being told that they have to use a state vehicle. I don't know that this legislation addresses that. I saw an amendment yesterday. I have not seen the current amendment. It's just our concern that our folks are going to be told to use a car and then be told that they have to reimburse for going home after an interim stop on a way to St. Cloud using your same example.
My understanding, based on what I know of IRC code, is that if it is for the employer's convenience, like you say, for an interim stop on the way somewhere, that is perfectly acceptable, that this brings us into compliance with federal code.
And Mr. Chairman, I can understand that. I am not one that believes that most directors have a pure and clean heart when it comes to state employees, and it's just our concern that this will be abused by the commissioners and assistant commissioners, and so we're going to keep a very close eye on this, and if we see that, we'll scream bloody murder. But it would be MAPE's position that we would be against this bill, unless it can be fixed to take care of those concerns.
Mr. Chair. Representative Paymer.
I have a question for Representative Haas. Okay. We're just reviewing the fiscal note, and I see the amount that would be deducted from employees' pay in return to the agencies, but I don't see, if you can just point me in the fiscal note where this is actually saving the state some money. I assume that was what your motivation was.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paymar, the savings to the state is, right now, we're not getting reimbursed for any of the expenses. We're spending $500,000 a year. And what we're trying to do is recuperate that cost from the employees, because we're paying for the gas, the vehicles, the insurance, the maintenance for these vehicles. And so that is what we're trying to accomplish here. So it is saving states some money, saving the taxpayer.
Where on the fiscal notice to say that?
Page 3, Representative Beamer. Ms. Roberts, could you clarify this?
Mr. Chair, members, you'll note on page 3 that the fiscal note does say that an estimated $613,000 would be deducted from employee pay and returned to the agencies. And so the reason the fiscal note is not showing a bottom line gain to the state is because those reimbursements would go to the agency that is paying for the vehicle. So the savings would be retained in the agency budget that's incurring the costs for the vehicle. So we don't cancel these reimbursements to the general fund and then show a general fund savings. It means that the agency's costs are going to be less because the reimbursements from the employee will go to them to help them pay for the cost of the vehicle. Did I make that clear or less clear?
Sure.
I guess what I'm trying to say is there's not any mechanism in this bill to kind of grab those savings and then just deposit them in the general fund. What happens to the savings is the agency gets to keep them because they're keeping the reimbursement from the employee. So it means the cost of the agency is less for the vehicle, but there's not a mechanism to capture those savings and cancel them to the bottom line. And I'm not sure if we'd be able to know at this point what portion of that would be general fund, what portion would be other funds because of these vehicles being spread out across state government.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Representative Moss. Earlier this year, we had a report from admin in regards to the vehicle fleet and the cost that the agencies are incurring for not having the reimbursement.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, I just want to follow up on what Mr. Bergson was raising. So, in other words, if the employer is requesting the employee to use a state car, then is this just extra money that's coming out of that employee's paycheck, or are they getting that? How are they getting that back if they're required or ordered to use the car?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Haas.
Representative Paymar, that's an interesting scenario where a supervisor says you have to use a state vehicle. I'd like to get a better clarification in those situations, but I think with this law, it clarifies that what the reimbursement is that employer pay, and then what is the personal use based on the IRS code. And if an employee is traveling out of town, it may be more cost effective for that employee to use a state vehicle that day rather than for us to reimburse the mileage. But if an employee is only using a vehicle or traveling a couple times a year, it's probably more cost effective to reimburse that employee for the personal use of their vehicle rather than give them a company car or a state vehicle to use.
Follow-up, Representative Paymar? To that point, Representative Paymar, in a case like that where the employer is saying, we want you to do this, we are requiring you to do this, my understanding of the regs would be that that is no longer a situation where it would be have to be reimbursed. It's not per se commuting at that point. If the employer is saying, you will do this, that is for the inconvenience of the employer rather than the employee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, I think the other thing is I think we have to educate some of these department heads and agency heads as far as what they are should be doing for mileage, because it's gotten so lax now that I don't think if you went to any one of the agencies, you know, department people or people who have vehicles, I don't think they could tell you the policy. And so it's admin's responsibility is to educate all people who are controlling vehicles in their agencies to what the policy is, and then they have to use their best discretion to keep their costs down. And what we want to do is, you know, my goal is to reduce the state fleet, because I think, and clearly from the lottery, you know, we had three vehicles just being driven back and forth to work every day. We should not have had a vehicle. And I'm sure that we have a situation down in Rochester where they're driving from Rochester to Eagan every day. I got an email, in fact, we checked it out and found out it was a DHS vehicle, I believe. The vehicle is being used to grocery shop on Sunday afternoon at noon. And I got an email from a fellow who came in the parking lot at the same time as the state vehicle did, parked right next to it, went into the store, shopped, came out the store the same time that the person who drove the vehicle did, and watched him roll the groceries in the car, and he wrote down the license plate and the vehicle number on the side of the car and emailed it to me, and we checked it out. And these are inappropriate uses, and we weren't getting reimbursed for that. You know, and in my mind, you know, that is a disciplinary action should be taken, because state law is violated in that situation. And, you know, and these are cases that are happening and nothing's being done. So this bill will set the guidelines. We need to educate agency heads in that, to manage it, and to notify their people, and to use their best discretion.
Thank you. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Austin, you touched on what I was going to bring up. It seems to me that this isn't an employee problem at all, that this is an agency problem, that this bill attempts to solve somehow at the expense of the employees. But, you know, what circumstances would there be that a vehicle was authorized for use that would result in an employee having to reimburse the state? There shouldn't be any such circumstance, should there? I mean, if you don't have to reimburse the state in the circumstance that Mr. Bergson described, in which employee has the vehicle because it was told to have the vehicle, then if the agency, if the person responsible for this was doing their job, there wouldn't be any circumstance in which an employee would be liable to reimburse the state. Isn't that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, you know, that is a big issue that we're trying to deal with also. And in my discussion with Mr. Bergson yesterday, he said, really, the problem isn't with our employees, it's with the management level people. They're the ones who have the vehicles. And what is the reason for the person having the vehicle? That's what we're trying to get at. And when you look at the inventory of vehicles, which is in your fleet report that we received in this committee, we still have a substantial amount of vehicles there. And we're trying to get to the core root of the whole problem and say, do you really need a vehicle? And there are certain people in this state that do need a vehicle to do their job. And that we understand. But for somebody just to drive back and forth to the office every day, there should not be a need. And why an agency head is allowing that person to have that car, I question strongly. So I think we're on the same track, and we're trying to get to the problem. And
well,
Representative Haas,
why are we trying to get to the problem by saying that the person that is being allowed to do something that shouldn't be allowed to do in the first place is supposed to pay for it, when the obvious solution is not to allow them to do it in the first place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I agree with you. But we have to, in the cases where they are using the state vehicle and they are going into the office, in our situations, I know in the private sector, there are salespeople. I've had company cars in the past. But even when I went out of town, I was required to reimburse the company for my average commute for that day to the office and back. Not, you know, if I drove to Eau Claire for the day, that's not personal mileage to get to the workplace. But they would charge me still the average commute. And that's no different than any ordinary citizen driving back and forth to work every day to get in their workplace. They're incurring expenses. But company vehicle sometimes is a convenience to have, so that instead of driving your vehicle out to make the sales calls, you know, and some companies require salesmen to come into the office every day, or reps or whatever type of business you are, and then from there you drive from, you know, with your company vehicle away from the site. But you drive your company vehicle in to get to the office and then take off. So there are some situations like that within state government. But you're correct. State law says they're not supposed to be using it for personal use. But I think what has happened is nobody's really enforced that. And then the IRS says if somebody is using a vehicle for personal use, they're supposed to, you know, there's a reimbursement rate or a tax rate. And we're saying the tax rate is very low. And in some cases, we're applying the formula that admin has used is $3 per day is added to the taxes, which breaks down, if you're in a 15% tax bracket, that's 45 cents a day is what you're paying the average commute, they're thinking is, if they're saying, come up with that, is 30 miles. Well, 30 miles under the normal IRS reimbursement rules is $10.88. And if we put it on the tax, the federal tax, the state still doesn't get reimbursed for any of our costs. The taxpayers still eat the cost. And so what we need to do is, first of all, if we are incurring expenses for a commute, say an agency head is driving, you know, or, you know, go back to the lottery report. You know, look at the cases in there. There's one car vehicle in the lottery report where they assigned it to one of the employees. Basically, that employee parked it in their driveway. Didn't want to drive the state vehicle. So we had a state vehicle sitting in their driveway all the time. You know, and I think there was I think 4,000 or 5,000 miles a year was put on that vehicle. Or here, 7,900 is what was put on that for the year, where her colleagues were putting on 20,000 to 28,000 miles a year. So, you know, this is what we're trying to get at, and we're saying that we got to reimburse the state for the cost of fuel, insurance, maintenance of that vehicle. That's what we're saying. And we're trying to also, you know, say that if you have a state vehicle, you know, first of all, I want to make sure that, and this is the other thing we're trying to get to, is the people who should have a state vehicle should have a state vehicle. And anything else, we should do away with.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Haas, I still have a problem here that if the real problem is that the people that are in control of these vehicles are not assigning them or paying attention to how they're being used properly, and as you said a few moments ago, the real problem is enforcement of rules that presumably already exist, then how are we ever going to collect a dime here? Because how are you ever going to find out that there was inappropriate use, since presumably all of the use that's being assigned with that vehicle is appropriate? How, you know, are we going to have people going around checking supermarket parking lots? How do you plan to enforce this?
Representative Wilty, we got a big job cut out for us, don't we, you and I? We'll be driving around the state looking for this stuff. No, first of all, you know, in private sector, they look at your commute back and forth. And then it's basically, you know, it's an honor system to report whether you're using that car for personal use or not. And that's where it would be. I think, again, we have to have admin make sure that all the agency heads and management people who were either use vehicles or assign vehicles to their employees understand the ruling, and it's going to be up to admin to make sure that this is done. This is going to be, you know, they need to start policing this, and this is something that hasn't been done for years. And so what happens is everybody's gotten complacent. You know, I got a car, do you want a car? You know, does Mr. Shepard want a car? You know, and then nobody turns in mileage. You know, I think that's kind of the thing, and it's just gotten out of hand. And we're just saying that, first of all, we got to get a handle on it. We're working on that part of it. And the second of all, that's flawed in our system is we're not being reimbursed the way we should be based on IRS code.
Any further questions from members? Would anyone from the Department of Administration like to testify to the bill or to the amendment, for that matter?
Okay. Are we voting on the amendment?
Yeah,
we
do have to vote on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion on the A1 amendment.
All right. To the H-1946-A1 amendment, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Haas, any further comment on the bill?
No, Mr. Chair. I think this is a fair way to do it, and it's a step in the right direction to controlling some of our costs and being reimbursed in a proper manner that is consistent with IRS code. So with that, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion for House File 1946.
And I believe that motion is to pass and go to the General Registry as amended, Representative Haas?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Haas renews his motion on House File 1946. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
I believe the motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
He might be in his office. Members, we're going to have House File 1681 before us, and we're only looking at two areas of this bill for our committee, I believe it is. And so we'll keep our discussion strictly to those areas. And again, we'll only take amendments to those specific areas. Welcome to Committee Representative Bradley. If you would, you need 2 seconds to get ready. I'll move House File 1681 be recommended to pass and then be referred to Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that having heard the comments from the chair, I assume that you sort of outlined the areas, and I think the area that we'll review really is the fiscal note that's titled preliminary, and I'll sort of take you through the really relevant. I think the section that is most relevant for understandability is pages here, really on page 4 or 5. Because I think that helps you understand sort of the elements that we're talking about. And just in sort of reminder of how what policies are that drive some expenses, potentially endure, the relevant sections are, first one is a section that asks Bureau to present a consumer-directed health care, health savings account option as they come to the labor negotiations. And so that's the first element of cost on page 4 or 5. And frankly, I thought it might be a little less, and I frankly believe that the department is already in this domain anyway doing work. But I think it is fair to say, as explained to me by Dewar, the Department of Employee Relations, that if we're going to bring an option to the table for negotiation, it has to be an option that has been actuarially reviewed very carefully, that is sound, that would work with other plans. So what you see there is a total of $100,000 in terms of the preparation, the consulting fees, those kinds of things. So that is the cost associated with that policy item. The second policy item, just down from that, is the cost of another proposal that we have in the bill, which is that we get better information about expenditures for prescription drugs. And specifically, our proposal was that we had quarterly reports provided on sort of explanation of benefits format. We've been working with both the department as well as working with health plans as well as the pharmacists, and have come up with a whole lot better plan. The plan that we now have in the bill that's before you is just that the fiscal note is a little behind. The plan now calls for the explanation of benefits to be done at time of claim. In other words, at the time that you're getting your prescription, you would be handed an explanation of benefit that would show you essentially kind of like a retail price, the amount of copay that you pay, and then the amount that the pharmacist is paid for that drug. Similar to what if you went to a hospital or other kind of places. And the letter that we got from the department on that one says that they believe, given that the cost will be minimal or negligible. But we don't have a specific number, just so you're aware of it. We don't have an up-to-date number yet. And if there's anybody here who does have that, it'll be fine. But I think what it shows really is that that's almost a part of the normal business, and I believe the information is available. So that should almost go away or be a negligible cost. The third item of cost is has to do with asking Dewar to be a partner with the Departments of Health, Department of Human Services, to identify three best practices that would then be tracked in the course of doing our health plan distribution. This would be
so that we would be sure, and I think the three are likely to be things like diabetes, asthma, heart treatment. Those are typically the ones where there's virtually no controversy on what's best practices, and I think we know by data that in most cases, less than half the people who are receiving those treatments are actually receiving what's known to be best practices treatment. If you look at the numbers, they're relatively small. The total amount is 32,604. I think the reason for that, frankly, is that because the department is in large measure really moving this direction, and almost every health plan in Minnesota is already moving in the direction of being sure that the purchase of health care is based on sound sciences. So it's a small investment, but I think a legitimate nudge, in a sense, to use it. So that's really the three pieces. It's hard to say exactly what the $266,000 would turn out to be, but if you look at, we're talking about $130,000 plus some odd change for that explanation of benefits proposal. So that, which I believe would be the cost, the budget numbers that would be relevant to this committee.
Okay. Mr. Representative Bradley, I see we have about $260,000 in there for the EOB.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
We have a cost for the EOB of $266,000 in my fiscal note?
Yes, yeah. Mr. Chair, but I think the explanation that we have, and I actually have a letter from the department saying, because that was originally done on the basis of quarterly report, and the current language now does it at time of claim, and they believe that that would become negligible in a very small amount instead.
Okay. So you're looking at 130?
Well, I was just told that the other two is 132,600, and then whatever comes through on the explanation of benefit, which again should be fairly small.
Okay. And the other thing is, Ms. Schultz.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd also like to mention that it's a technical issue with respect to how fast this bill is moving from one committee to the next, and the timing that the agency has and to be able to do the updates as it needed, as needed. So what you have in the numbers before you is an earlier version of the bill, and what Representative Bradley has been talking about is what we have currently, and we're trying to play catch up. And so that's why you have a 266, which we know will be a significantly less number. And let me remind you also that a negligible fiscal impact would be less than $25,000. And I'd also point out that all of these costs would be associated with the state employee insurance fund and not general funds.
So, Michelle, you're saying these will come out of the CGEP reserve fund?
Yes.
So there is no impact then to our budget?
That's correct. Okay. There's no impact to the general fund portion.
Okay. And the other thing that I see in here in the fiscal note assumption, and maybe Doerr can, I think there's a Mr. Haugen's here from Doerr. I see in the consulting hours to develop a HSA product, it seems 500 hours to develop a product, which is pretty standardized in the legislation. Seems extremely high. And could you address that, Mr. Haugen? Identify yourself for the record. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm David Haugen with the Minnesota Department of Employee Relations. And the fiscal note is based on our interpretation of the bill in looking at the requirements for preparing a health savings account option for bargaining. I think it's important to understand that nearly 90% of our 48,000 employees are represented by a bargaining unit. Bargaining is a very oftentimes complex and challenging undertaking. I think we would have to assume that anything that we offered up in bargaining could potentially be accepted and would have to be incorporated as part of the benefit offerings for our employees. To that end, we were understanding the bill and interpreting it to mean to come to the table with a very valid offer that we could certainly implement and use effectively with any other offerings that we might have in place, including our current Advantage program, and that certainly we would need a great deal of actuarial assistance in looking at that, making this available in bargaining. Also, in order to adequately cost this out and get the parameters of this program in order to offer this in bargaining, we felt we should go through an RFP process, and so this estimate also includes the cost for generating an RFP, reviewing the RFP, narrowing or selecting a potential bidder, as well as looking at the whole issue of how this kind of an account might relate to other existing plans like our Advantage plan. Certainly a major issue, I think, would be the potential for some possible adverse selection. Currently, as you may be aware, we're a self-funded plan, which means that if we have healthy employees incurring no claims, we're really not paying out any money on those employees because we pay claims as a self-funded plan.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, under the design of an HSA account, it's conceivable that by offering a high deductible account with some kind of associated, a high deductible plan with some kind of associated medical savings account or health savings account, that in fact there may be healthy employees whom we otherwise would pay nothing for who might now be getting something in the form of an account payment, and that would be a cost that we would have to take into account and deal with. So given the complexity, size, and scope of the bargaining activities, as well as the potential impact on the pool, which is now approaching the vicinity of about a $400 million a year annual expenditure, we were anticipating this level of due diligence and preparation just to make sure this all worked out well.
Mr. Haugen, the easiest way to do this, first of all, since we are self-insured, you can self-insure an HSA.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have that, we don't have to go out to the fully insured market. We can keep it within our risk pool. So I think, you know, to go out for an RFP, we can use our existing carriers to pay claims, to use their networks, and then we, as a state, under the self-insurer, just offer the option. So I don't think we, you know, we're not going to incur all this expense because we don't have to go through all these steps. Because everything, I think, is in place to do it, and since we can do it, since we're self-insured, we can just do it. It's just a matter of, you know, we'll have some plan design, and actually that's very simple. It's just maybe it's a little actuarial work just to set the rate for the high deductible plan, but then that premium goes into our risk pool to pay claims over and above the high deductible. So I think we can revise these numbers down considerably from what we're proposing here because we don't have to go through all these steps at this point because I think we're already there.
Mr. Chairman, if I may ask...
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I heard you say something about $500. Are you looking at the 250 RFP?
There's two. There's a development and an RFP, 250 hours each for $50,000, as it shows in my...
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
On page two.
I got you.
Yep. So I just think we can cut that down considerably and just use some actuarial work, and we can design the plans. You know, give them a basic design based on what the law states, and the actuaries can figure out what our rate should be for that.
Mr. Chair, my reaction is I would certainly welcome your advice. I think in the end, it would be some type of formal fiscal note. I think we've had one stage, one kind of one spin where I gave some advice. And I think if you have some additional ways that we might, I do respect, however, the need to be sure that when we do it, that it's done right so that if it is chosen as an option, that you can deal with the kind of mix. I know the teacher plan that's being worked on includes a couple of consumer-directed as well, so it's not new ground entirely. I respect the fact that we've got to make sure we do it right.
Right.
If we can reduce this a little bit, I'm certainly open to that.
Yeah, and I think Mr. Haugen could have the discussion with our current plans to see what they have in place and how that would work for them, and then go from there to see what the actuary is going to need, and then I think we would have our number to what it would be. And then I think we'd cover the bases. So we can discuss that further and have dialogue on that. Questions from members? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bradley, I think I followed you on the three points that you were making. First two points you were discussing, the fact that we're dealing only with costs for the purposes of this hearing. And then the third point you were making, you began discussing Article 2, which involved best practices. I just want to make sure that I understand correctly, excuse me, that for the purposes of this hearing today, you're not asking us to accept the definition of best practices under Article 2. Am I correct?
Representative Bradley.
Representative Newman, That's correct. The only thing that we're doing here is suggesting to us as purchasers, both Dewar and DHS, that we adopt three of the known best practices and make that part of our negotiations, part of our tracking, to make sure that what we're purchasing follows those trends. And those are the safe ones. Those would typically be, as I think is already sort of in process, diabetes, heart disease, asthma, those kinds of things.
Thank you, Representative Brown.
Follow up, or okay. Any further questions? All right. Then, anyone else here to testify for or against this portion of the bill? Ms. Blyle and Mr. Bergson. Thank you, Mr. Hogan. Welcome to committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 6, the State Employees Union. And I have to respectfully disagree with Representative Bradley on this section of the bill altogether. From a bargaining standpoint, I don't think it's necessary for the legislature to be delving in and putting proposals into state law that the Department of Employee Relations needs to offer during negotiations. And the second concern that I would raise today is the use of the Employee Insurance Trust Fund monies. Those obviously are employee dollars in that fund as well. And I do understand the fiduciary responsibility with the fund, but as to using utilization of those funds to be able to follow up on a proposal that the legislature is putting forth that the department now may offer during bargaining, in our mind, is a step further than the legislature ought to be going. It should be leaving the bargaining process to the Department of Employee Relations and the unions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bergson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Bergson, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. A couple of years ago, when the legislature first decided to step into the realm of negotiating our contract in terms and conditions of employment for us by taking away a benefit that we had negotiated with the employer, I was told at that time by the legislature and legislative leadership that the legislature would never again step into the realm of negotiating the contract for us. Well, here we go again. You're taking $100,000 of state tax dollars to contract out a job that you already have a full-time staff set up to do. The state pays Department of Employee Relations a full-time negotiator plus a full-time staff that is set up to plan and negotiate the state's position when they come to deal with us at contract negotiations. Now you're giving them an extra $100,000 to come up with a plan that we're not going to agree with. And in contract negotiations, you need both sides to agree. And I can say that we don't take too kindly again to having the legislature mandate the terms and conditions of our employment. And secondly, we don't know where these contract dollars are going to go to. The state has, in the past, contracted overseas. And it's ironic to me that the only jobs that the current administration has created are in India. And so now we find this egregious, beyond reproach, and we will not agree to it when it comes before us. So it's basically an exercise in futility for the legislature to go down this track. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Bergson, I don't know if you're aware of it, but in the HSA law, if I was working for an employer, could come into my employer and say, I'm opting out of the group plan because I want to set up an HSA, and I can opt out of the group plan for an HSA, and the employer has to allow me. And I think what we're saying in this bill is we're giving the employees the option if they want an HSA account, because you may have some members out there that what happens if they come to the state and you've bargained that they won't be able to get an HSA and they want an HSA? Well, and they come directly to us. They purchase a private HSA and then we have to make contributions to it. I think we got a little dilemma here, and so we're saying it's an option and then, you know, is available because there's other employees that aren't in the unions that may want to also take an HSA. So I understand and I respect your, you know, where you're coming from, and I probably feel the same way, but I think when you look at the overall law, in the way it's written, that any employee can opt out of group insurance and take an HSA.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
which could complicate, you know, your situation. I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, not unless we all agree to it. I mean, it's contract negotiations. If we don't agree, they aren't going to be able to opt out. You just can't opt out in Minnesota unless the legislature changed PELRA, which we fully expect to come in the future. But I think our concern is that you have a full-time staff already. Mm-hmm. And now you're going to give them an extra $100,000 to stack the deck against the unions again. And if they can't do their own work, and they need an extra 250 professional hours at the average cost of $200 per hour. None of my people make $200 an hour. All of our contract negotiators come out of the rank and file. They volunteer. They don't get paid. And that's what we're up against. I mean, you're just stacking the deck against the employees once again, and it just doesn't seem like it's very fair. And it just seems like it's ill-conceived and just a bad policy. And that's our union's position.
Okay. Well, as you heard my previous discussion about questioning the professional hours used, I think this is way inflated. But we're not dealing with state law. We're dealing with federal law on HSA. And that's what we're dealing with. Because the federal law is what Minnesota is complying with in the HSA accounts.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Okay. And Mr. Burson, if you want to, you know, sit down and discuss it, I can kind of show you, because I've got all the briefs and stuff like that. Because of my profession, I've been very heavily involved in that whole issue. So we can talk further on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So Representative Rhodes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, I just want to, could you response to the comments that were made by both of them? I just want to come see where you're coming from on this stuff.
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rhodes, I certainly welcome the opportunity. I hope that it's been carefully analyzed. We are not trying to usurp the labor negotiation process. As a matter of fact, we're very carefully not trying to do that. And I think it is totally in line for us to suggest to our Commissioner Dewar that an instrument of insurance that is sweeping the market, and I think will sweep the market, ought to be understood, and ought to at least be understood well enough to come to the table with the negotiating. Now, we may differ. I mean, I think it won't be too long before a lot of our labor groups will actually be asking for this kind of option. I think we saw a case in Rochester where Homestead Medical Center, with 1,000 employees, opted for kind of a predecessor of this using the HRA, the health reimbursement account, and the employees are extremely excited about it. I realize that it's sort of new territory, but we are not at all. The wording was careful. Commissioner Cal Lehman has responded to me appreciating the kind of the encouragement to get educated in this field. Now, I can't speak to what skills are available. I do believe, however, that the department is telling us we may have negotiating skills in-house, but I'm not so sure about the actuarial skills. The actuarial skills are typically contracted, and I think that's more what this area is.
Representative Bradley, you bring up a good point. I know a number of people are confusing HRAs, the health reimbursement accounts, with the health savings accounts that were just signed into law December 1st. And so I think that's because there are two different animals, really. Any further discussion? If not, then, members, I renew my motion that House File 1681 be recommended pass and then be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr.
Members, we are done, and so our next meeting is going to be March 9th, 2:30. So thank you, and have a great day. Meeting adjourned.